According to the Japanese, the five great terrors are earthquakes, thunders, floods, fires, and father. And to most of them, I imagine, father is the principal cause of anxiety. But these people, incidentally, have on average are from 1,200 to 1,500 earthquakes a year. Therefore, it is only natural that they've given some thought to the matter. And while their thinking is perhaps a little empirical, it may be well to consider it for a moment and see if we can learn something that is a little different from the present approach to the problems of these seismic catastrophes. The Japanese believe that earthquakes are caused by a catfish. Now, this is perhaps an exaggeration, but it is called the pivot fish, and it is somewhere asleep under Japan. And every once in a while, it wiggles and shakes its tail, and down comes a city or two. And this has resulted in a peculiar love for catfish. About 6 months ago, there was a prophecy in Japan of a serious impending earthquake. What happened? Everybody that could do so bought a catfish. Instead of moving or anything of that nature, they found either a little pond or a bowl or a tank or something and put the catfish in it. And thousands of years of experience has taught them that the first thing that will note or register an impending earthquake is a catfish. The moment that fish gets excited, hysterical, wiggles around and tries to jump out of the tank, every one of the villagers head for the bamboo groves. They know an earthquake is coming, and it comes. Now, this led to a series of interesting experiments concerning the possibility of the foreknowledge of earthquakes. We are inclined to suspect at the present time that sonar or radar or something of that nature is the factor that causes animals, birds, and other non-human creatures to have better awareness of earthquake difficulties than the average human being. But in the Orient, there's another factor involved that seems to be worthwhile to consider. Some years ago, about the middle of the 19th century, a Japanese watch repairer had the habit of hanging the small parts of a watch's mechanism on magnets to keep them so he could get them when he wanted them and they wouldn't get lost or disappear. One day, while he was hard at work with one of his watches, all of these magnets discharged the pieces hung on them. And there was a little crash of small parts falling on his workbench. He didn't pay much attention to it at that moment, but about 10 minutes later, the earthquake hit. So this began to be a matter of consideration. The villagers picked it up, and they had an earthquake alarm that probably is one of the earliest that we know. This consisted of a large iron ball hung from a magnet, and below the ball was a bronze or iron dish, large, like a great boiler. And the warning was that if the ball dropped on the metal dish and made a loud noise, it was a good idea for the people to head for the bamboo grove. Why the bamboo grove? Obviously, because the roots of the bamboo knot into tangles that are so tight that the ground can open under them and the roots will hold up anyone who is hanging onto the roots. So this was a way in which they began to experiment with earthquake phenomena. And, of course, with the susceptibility of that country, such research and such study was certainly important. It may be that, like acupuncture and several other Oriental methods of handling situations, we will ultimately have more interest, not necessarily in iron balls or detached magnets, but in the general theory that they have, namely, that an earthquake is always heralded by a form of natural magnetism being disarranged. This disarrangement, however, is not followed instantly by the earthquake. It may be followed within an hour or so, or it may be followed the next day. But the warning is almost always ultimately met with an appropriate termination. There is an earthquake. Years ago, it was noted that animals had peculiar ability to anticipate earthquakes. There was a very important quake off the coast of Peru, and a large part of the coastline fell into the sea. This coastline had for years been a grazing ground for cattle. They grazed free in this area. When it fell off into the sea, there was not a single head of cattle lost. They had all quietly left. And many other such accounts are known to anticipate the possibility that earthquakes are perhaps a magnetic phenomena, as well as possibly a physical one. Some have assumed, and there's been some scientific support for this, that an earthquake begins in the heavy side layer of the atmosphere, that it is very much like a discharge of lightning. It is something which, as energy, strikes an area where the fission lines of the planet are particularly susceptible. This blow, this stroke of energy, results in a motion of the physical earth. Now, trying to work out some of these mysteries, we go back to Plato's account of the sinking of Atlantis. He was very simple in his repetition of the information received from Solon, who in turn had gained it from the Egyptians. According to Plato, the great Atlantic catastrophe was a punishment for sin. It was the way in which the gods avenged the abuse and misuse of the privileges and powers which they had bestowed upon mankind. The corruption of human usage, the misuse of earth energies, the pollution of earth's resources, we would say could, in the end, of course, bring about such a disaster. But to the Greeks, it was not only brought about, but it was ordered, arranged, and fulfilled by divine will. The gods were responsible for punishing the guilty. Looking into the problems as we know them in our daily life, the ancients, particularly following the Hermetic disciplines, believed that the microcosm, which is man, was a miniature of all other things that exist in nature, and that the human being was the most available textbook for the study of any type of phenomena that can arise in the larger environment. We know very much now concerning the causes of sickness, not all, but quite a bit. We know also the effect of dispositions upon health. We realize how the abuse or misuse or corruption of human emotions or thoughts will ultimately destroy the body. We also realize how excesses and the abuse of the natural resources of the body can result in premature infirmity. All of these factors are more or less generally recognized. But how would we apply such a situation or such a condition to the larger world in which we live? The universal environment. To the ancients, one and all, east and west, the planet Earth was considered to be a living thing. It was not just simply a mass of metals or substances or lava or rocks whirling around in space. It was a being with the attributes of a being. And one of their reasons for assuming this is that nothing can produce nothing. And the fact that this planet maintains an infinite diversity of life dependent upon the planet would make it appear or be assumed that the planet itself was a source of life and therefore must be alive. For that which is dead cannot be the source of life. Now, the planet itself, we want to consider it as a living thing, which practically all of ancient people did. They considered it a goddess, the great mother of all life, and that from this great mother came forth all of the kingdoms of material existence in this world. That the planet Earth was the great nurse, the mother. It was the bride of the sun and the daughter or wife of God. It was the symbol of the productiveness and fruitfulness of existence so far as the human being was concerned. Assuming as the ancients did, and perhaps with proper insight, better than we have, because we are now determined to make everything sterile, mechanical, physical, material, and to deny all other factors in the constitutions of living things. The ancients did not have this point of view, and someone will say, well, maybe we outgrew what the ancients thought. Maybe they were superstitious and wrong, and we are right. But let us give a second thought to that. Most of the wisdom of antiquity originated before what we may call the age of sophistication. Ancient peoples were simple. They'd had very little to unlearn. They were not surrounded by highly opinionated specialists who were constantly interfering with the natural processes of the heart and mind. They were not overwhelmed by schools. They were not dominated by widespread theories. They were not made up primarily of scoffers or cynics. They were very simple, natural people, and their wisdom was the wisdom of the folk. Now, the folk, perhaps, in its wisdom, like the folk in its art, has a tremendous integrity. It represents the natural reaction of the individual, directed and moved by common sense and by the common experiences of daily life. Therefore, the primitive instincts and intuitions of humanity may well be more correct than the sophisticated, involved doctrines and beliefs that we hold to today. In any event, the ancient peoples were inclined to think of the earth as a living thing. It was not simply a footstool for deity, nor was it merely some kind of a meteor floating in space. It was a being, part of a great hierarchy of beings inhabiting space. The Buddhists called this great space family a cosmotheism, and they said that it was a vast cosmic space democracy. That in this was all the law that man could possibly need or use, that every aspect of life that was necessary for the protection and unfoldment of human society was already traced in the universe itself, and that there was no way in which we could go against the universe and survive, or at least survive with dignity. Now, assuming for a moment that the earth is alive, at least it is vital. It may not have a disposition like ours, although sometimes it seems to be almost miraculously wise and clever. It seems to have abilities to solve problems that human beings cannot solve. One thing we know definitely is that the earth, as the alchemist pointed out, is a kind of great bottle. And in this bottle is an infinite mixture of chemical factors. This bottle contains within it all of the elements necessary for the production of the philosopher's stone, or the transmutations of all gross substances into their mystical and spiritual equivalents. Now, if this planet is a bottle, then like all other bottles, it has capacity. Like all other bottles, it can only be filled, and it can only be emptied. And unless something is taken from it, no more can be added once it is full. And if there is no source for the replenishment of the contents of the bottle, then when it is empty, that is the end. So at the moment, some people, including a number of Chinese researchers, are beginning to question whether or not man is wise in constantly exploiting the natural resources of the earth. Is it perfectly pleasant, happy, safe, and sound, and quite in the order of things, to drain out petroleum? Is it proper to go on mining for the natural metals and elements of the earth? Is it possible to go through all kinds of processes of transformations resulting in corruption of the atmosphere and pollution of the water? What are we doing to this tired old person that we call the earth? If it is really a person, it is in a pretty poor shape and is getting poorer all the time. Now we know that the gravitational pull of the earth and its relation to the sun and the orbits of the other planets, that these are controlled factors. And these controlled factors, in all probability, depend upon the internal construction of the earth itself. It has to have certain polarities. It has to have certain resources in order to remain in its orbit as it should. If human ingenuity depletes the natural resources and energies of the planet until nothing remains, its fertility is very apt to be destroyed, and it may sometime, like the broken planet, which is now called Lucifer, be disintegrated in space because it has been exhausted of its resources. Come down to the human being. It may be occasionally necessary for a man to give a little blood to a neighbor who is in trouble, so there's a blood transfusion. But if this individual was required to give transfusions every day throughout his life, he'd be dead in a few weeks. And if we take from the earth the vital necessities by a kind of transfusion and then dissipate them in our own industrialized culture, we are ultimately going to land in a very serious disaster. And this disaster can include nearly every type of cataclysm because of the various forms of depletion of which we are guilty. Now, there's no real need to get terribly excited about this, perhaps, because it's not likely to happen in our lifetimes, or maybe for many more centuries to come. But unless something is done to conserve resources, there is no question in the world that ultimately the energy bottle will be empty. And when that happens, we are going to find many very difficult situations to face. If you study the human being very carefully, you must realize also that the microcosm, which is man, is a little solar system in itself. There are planets within the human body, and to the various vital organs, planetary correspondences have been assigned. There are also various systems within the body which can be separated by the autopsy physician. There is the nervous system. There is the arterial system, the venous system, the lymphatic system. There are muscles and sinews and bones, systems of structures which, by working together and receiving appropriate nutrition, maintain the equilibrium of man's physical existence. Now, if various artificial means are used to corrupt the health of the individual, these systems are going to be impaired. And through various dissipations or indifferences or wrong attitudes, the entire bodily structure can be damaged. Actually, it appears also that the human being has a territorial allotment, like the tiger, the lion, the elephant, and the bear. When he sets up headquarters somewhere, he sets aside a territory. And within this territory, he must exist. He must feed himself and his young. He must do whatever is necessary to survive. And he must defend this territory against encroachment. In man, what we would term the territory may be likened to the magnetic field of the human body. The ancients were well aware of this. Plato, Plutarch, and several others have written about it. And they have also noted that the physical body of man exists within a kind of invisible bubble, which has been called in metaphysics the aura. This has been photographed. It can be seen with the aid of the Kilner screens. And its effect, in terms of magnetism, can be estimated with great certainty. And in his researches, Rickenbach was very clear in his ability to show and demonstrate the magnetic environment around every living thing. Now, if the human body has a magnetic field, then this magnetic field becomes the real source of the life of that body. This magnetic field envelops the physical form. It is the source of that form. It is the direct energizer of it. The life in man is not within the body, but within the magnetic field, and it communicates with the body through a series of very sensitive structures, of which the endocrine system is an example. This body, which contains the vital organs that we know, is therefore surrounded by a territory. That part of universal space which is allotted to the growth, development, and maintenance of a single creature. Everyone has this type of magnetic field, and it has been used in a number of interesting ways. It not only is apparent from an energy standpoint, but is probably responsible for most of the parapsychological phenomena that we know today, much of which we accept without question. It is probably involved in the system of acupuncture. It is involved in the yin-yang concepts of the Tao Te Ching and all of these ancient systems. For our purpose at the moment, though, the idea is that this bottle, which is the magnetic field, not only encloses us, but serves as a kind of capacity which we have. Our mental, emotional, and physical activities reflect into this. Our thoughts go into this magnetic field, change its color, change its structure, and can in many instances damage it. Our emotional pressures do the same thing. And photographing and studying the magnetic fields, as Kilner did, reveals clearly that the emotions and attitudes of persons change the colors of the magnetic field, change the vibratory rates of this auric structure in which we exist. If these auric rates are damaged by negative attitudes, it's hard to imagine, for instance, that a neurotic attitude could cause rheumatic situations in the body. It probably couldn't, unless this attitude went first into the magnetic field and then was then siphoned into the body through one of the endocrine glands. In any event, we have a physical body that is extremely sensitive to the law of cause and effect. Every attitude that we have has its own life principle. Words and thoughts are living things, and they feed into the magnetic field, and from there are fed back again into the body of the person. We find the same type of problem in smog. The Earth's atmosphere accepts the smog of industry and then returns it with interest, bringing with it a condition which is desperately dangerous to human survival. The same way with all of the inventions and discoveries of man. Everything by which man endangers the integrity of his own integration is dangerous to the common good and to his own personal survival. So in this magnetic field, there is a chemistry constantly going on. And this chemistry does react into the body. And a series of wrong attitudes will result in a detriment to the physical form. In the same way, wrong physical habits, as narcotics, alcohol, and other forms of dissipation, these variously deplete and disorganize the energy field. And when the energy field is sick, it is very difficult for the person to break the physical habit, because the habit is not in his body, but in the magnetic field where he has built it up by constant repetition of the mistake. So we have this to think of in human beings. Now let's move this out into the universe. Let us assume, as Ptolemy pointed out, and most of the ancients, that the Earth has a magnetic field. That this magnetic field surrounds and involves the substance of the planet and carries within it not only its own impressions, but a certain contribution that is made from other magnetic fields. Energy enters the human magnetic field through the crown of the head and above it, and goes out at the bottom. The planetary magnetic field is nourished through the polar cap at the north, and the excretion of destroyed, disintegrated, or useless material is through the south polar cap. The aurora borealis and the aurora australasia are evidences of the motion of magnetism through the Earth. And sometimes this motion is extraordinary. Then we see that the Earth itself is a kind of bottle contained within a larger vessel, which is its own magnetic field. And everything that has to do with the preservation of the Earth itself, everything that has to do with the development of the Earth and its various policies and processes, these things take place within the magnetic field, which incidentally extends beyond the orbit of the moon. Therefore, the solar energy entering the Earth's system also comes in through the polar region, which was supposed to be the abode of the gods and the Mount Olympus or the Mount Meru or the Simuru of India. It was from the north, therefore, that this energy flows in through the sacred island of the Gobina. So we have a great magnetic structure here, which is being continually influenced by human activity. Now, we know that the human being is a comparatively small fraction of Earth life. But if we think of the human being, perhaps, as a little like the locust, or a little like the marching ants, we learn in time that these little creatures, in infinite multiplication, can completely desolate a continent. That the major grand motions of humanity, which gradually infect every nation and every race, constitute a very powerful magnetic force. A great many people today are quite convinced that spiritual healing is possible through the laying on of hands, through prayer, through meditation, or through the cultivation of knowledge of the magnetic structure of the body. This was perhaps very well set forth in the writings of Andrew Jackson Davis, the New England physician. In any event, this process of increasing contamination must not be completely overlooked. But now, because of the nature of the scoffer, who is always with us, and is a useful agent, there's no doubt in the world that the devil's advocate plays a vital part in human progress. But the question is, what caused earthquakes before there were human beings? This is a very good one. It helps us to get rid of the responsibilities of our own conduct and make everything look better. There is no doubt in the world that in the very primitive period of things, we have situations very much again like we have in the development of the human being. We have many forces from the outside working upon the prenatal epoch of a planet. We also have, as with growth, the processes through which a planet passes in the process of its own maturity. Therefore, at the very primitive times, it would seem that most natural disasters were partly due to the birth travail of a planet, that these disasters resulted from the constant bombardment of this planet with the forces that made it into a planet. But even in comparatively older times, we find there were several different kinds of disasters. One might well be the one that we find in the human being, where heredity becomes a disaster. We know that the life principle of the planet lives here, but was carried here from another location in space. This is merely an incarnation of an entity, this planet. This incarnation had its own karma. It had its own problems to work out. And this is true also in various kinds of birth problems that we have and note at the present time. But actually, the obvious solution seems to be that before the planet was inhabited, there were no creatures as we know them to be affected by these transmissions of energy. Therefore, no one was hurt, no one was killed, but the planet, in its great processes of integration, went through these formative periods. Back as far as history, however, goes, two processes go side by side. One is human corruption, and the other is natural disaster. They are intimately related from the beginning of human thought. And we know that a great many ancient peoples were troubled by earthquake phenomena. Unfortunately, we have very few records of very ancient earthquakes. The most ancient that we do have records of are in the records of China, which kept these accounts more closely because it carried them into its astronomical system and was already aware of the cycles of the year and the great Plutonic year. So the problems that we face are very largely those which involve humanity as it is at the present time. We know, for instance, that a few terrorists or anarchists or even an individual who is corrupted can cause a tremendous amount of world damage. A few discontented, uninformed or misinformed human beings can bring terror and sorrow to the lives of millions of people. This type of phenomena seems also to be carried into the earth structure, and there seems to be no reason to doubt that human attitudes do have an effect upon natural phenomena as well as social and political phenomena. If the selfishness of people can cause nations to lose their individuality, and great and powerful states usurp the privileges and rights of smaller but equally meritorious peoples, then it is obvious that a small number of persons can produce a startling and dangerous physical phenomena. And this is likewise true if we think of the larger things. The attitudes of 4.5 billion human beings brought together in various patterns and around various confusions can certainly damage the Earth's atmosphere and affect its magnetic field. That which we can allow to be affected by smog or water pollution would be the atmosphere, but that which is affected by psychic pollution would be the magnetic field, and both will be subject to trouble and even the cause of further trouble unless the conditions are corrected by proper and watchful guidance. The answer, again, in this matter seems to be very simple. There are laws governing life. When we break these laws, we bring upon ourselves inevitable retribution. This was the concept of Plato in the New Atlantis. We cannot misuse without suffering. Now, the ignorance of very primitive people caused their abuses and misuses to be comparatively simple. They made their mistakes. They invented clubs and bows and arrows and slingshots. But they were comparatively sparse in number, and at the time probably at which the prehistoric man was most dangerous to himself, the population of the Earth probably was less than 50 million human beings. Today, it is 4.5 billion. This tremendous increase also increases the effect of human attitudes upon the planet, causing it to become more and more involved in the various processes set in motion by human activity. Actually, therefore, it's not surprising to find out that earthquakes have been rather frequent recently. They have always existed in fair numbers, and mostly they follow a certain cycle or circle of location. Most of the great earthquakes of the world have been Asiatic. They have also been along the great cycle which we call circle of fire, which bounds the Pacific Ocean. In these areas, earthquakes have always been comparatively frequent. Actually, however, we do not realize just exactly how serious or how constant the damage is. According to available statistics, in the present century, between 1901 and 1982, the loss of life by earthquakes on this planet has exceeded 1.5 million. This tremendous loss of life by this one cause alone is a cause of considerable thoughtfulness. Studying the statistics also, we observe that there is a distinct relationship between these earthquakes and attitudes and problems arising in human society. We find that great motions of political structure, particularly when accompanied by violence, murder, rape, and carnage, that such motions are almost inevitably followed by some form of seismic disaster, or, if not that, a plague, a pestilence, a drought, a flood, or some natural evidence of divine disapproval. This type of situation is so consistent that it really behooves us to be more thoughtful than we are inclined to be. Actually, also, there must be and is a direct relationship between the earthquake phenomena and the broad cycle of human activity. Since the middle of the 19th century, the world in all has moved slowly but inevitably into an industrial economy. The small shop with the man behind his own bench for life has disappeared. Great monopolies have arisen, vast combines and conspiracies, and little by little, the world has become almost completely involved in a desperate economic materialism. Nothing means anything except profit. Now, when a person gets into this situation, he gets into trouble, too. All over this world today, there are people suffering from nothing but the pressure of present prevailing policies. They are shortening life, destroying happiness, depriving the person of the privilege of improving himself through thoughtfulness and proper activities. Little by little, he is being bound to the wheel of Ixion, which is turning constantly upon an economic pivot. As a result of this situation, the whole world's level of consciousness is lowering. Now, this in itself, of course, is part of natural law, because the lowering of these cultural levels also produces discords, unhappiness, misery, privation, sickness, mental and emotional breakdown, the increase of crime, and the shortening of life expectancy. All of these things, therefore, result from a wrong basic attitude toward life. If nature had really intended to be on the profit system, it could have made a moderate charge for each of us when we came in here. Nature could have dictated that each individual had to offer something upon the altar in recognition of his own birth. But in nature, all of the good things that we enjoy are essentially free. The only cost lies in the distribution of them. But gradually, things have become valuable in their own right. We have taken possession of natural resources as though we owned them, when in actuality, we do not own them, any more than we own our own body, which can be destroyed by a few drops of some type of toxin. Therefore, we are always living in a natural world which we are exploiting and trying to divert to our own purposes. We want to industrialize the earth. We want to have a commuter in every family. We want to have everything all lined into a purely industrial profit-making process. We do not mind how many people we displace with machines. We do not give much consideration to the production of the higher types of life that we desperately need for leadership. We are corrupted in our entertainment and in our literature. Everything has been sacrificed. Now, when we get to a state of this kind, something is going to happen because of this mysterious factor that Plato calls the gods. If we do not wish to assume that they are gods, that is our privilege. But we must at least accept the immutability of natural law. And to the ancients, the will of God was natural law, because the laws of nature, according to them, arose in the divine consciousness. Therefore, there are rules in the game. And wherever the rules have been broken, there has been disaster. Wherever we desperately attempt to protect, preserve, and exaggerate these mistakes, the disasters increase. Humanity gradually undermines its own securities and its own health. We are troubled today with crime, with everything you can think of that is disastrous and annoying. And yet, we overlook all this because of the tremendous drive of success, which has become an obsession with most human beings. All right, we do this. And gradually, we are going to wreck 4.5 billion human beings. Maybe by the time we wreck them, There'll be more than that. Maybe there'll be 5 or 6 billion. But they will be born into a kind of psychological slavery. They will have no thinking of their own. They will have no will and purpose of their own. Everyone will be bowing constantly and eternally to profit. This type of situation affects not only ourselves, but our relation with the animal world. We are completely disturbing our ecology. Everything there that nature set up as the chain of nutritions, the change of propagations, all these things are being disrupted, endangered, and nullified. Almost wherever we have a field where we should be growing tomatoes, we're putting a condominium on it. Little by little, we are sitting on the end of a branch and cutting it off between ourselves and the tree. This type of thing cannot go on without a natural reaction that will be painful but inevitable. 4.5 billion people, all making more or less the same mistakes, certainly will have an effect upon the atmosphere. This atmosphere, in our own more intimate associations, becomes a contaminated life vitality source. When we breathe, we not only breathe in the smog, but in a mysterious way, in the abstract life energy inhalation, we breathe in the corruption, we breathe in the perversions which are dominant in our world. Our very water, earth, air, all these things are affected adversely by our own ignorance, stupidity, and avarice. So we are getting constantly polluted nutrition. Now our little problem is tied in to a bigger one. There is a food chain that leads all the way to the sun and the stars. There is a certain natural distribution of life energy which was preordained and made necessary by laws far beyond our comprehension. We only live because we are part of a chain of laws which will provide us as long as we do not corrupt them. So the earth itself is a source of energy for man, and man's conduct becomes a kind of karmic reaction which goes into the atmosphere of the planet. The magnetic field of the planet is much more subtle than the physical. In the physical field, we are polluting it day and night. In the more subtle ideological fields, we are also polluting those day and night. We are gradually corrupting the source of energies upon which we depend for survival. As this source of energy is corrupted, we notice a corresponding depression in our affairs. Obviously, the highest forms of our energy supply are the first to be sickened. The more attenuated, the more subtle, the more difficult, the more rare and valuable perish first. Therefore, little by little, the mind loses the power for the higher phases of thinking, which are so necessary to it. The emotions lose the nutrition which breeds love and friendship.